Welcome to another episode of Women in STEM, where we talk to women involved in science, technology, engineering, mathematics, and medicine. So our guest for this episode is Dr. Heather Bray, who is living proof that there is life for a scientist outside of the laboratory. Starting her career in agricultural science, she has transitioned over the years into science communication and is currently researching community attitudes towards gene technology and farm animal welfare, with an eye towards improving the conversation between both sides of the fence. But before we find out about that, let's start with the traditional question. How did you get involved in science?
I was very fortunate to grow up in a family that was curious. We were very working class. No one in my immediate family had gone to university. My uncle went to university and he got in at the year that they changed the number of high school years. So he got in when there were no other school leavers going in. So he was able to go as a mature age student. But we loved books and we watched ABC and I had a lot of books around, and I really got into archaeology. It was actually history that I really wanted to do. And by the time I got to high school and I was learning about what science was, I was also learning history as well, but I think it was learning about what science was that I found out I was good at it. I enjoyed it. And then I started doing agriculture because my school had a school farm. And that was like science plus. And there was a bit of history in it as well, because we ended up talking about things like the development of the Constitution in Australia and how we've got free trade between the states. And we talked about early agricultural pioneers, as well as, you know, how plants use nitrogen to grow. And I loved that. And I loved being at the farm and being able to really experience experimentation in a way that I couldn't in science at the time.
So you got your Bachelor of Science in Agriculture. Where did you go after you graduated?
I stayed where I was, actually, to do my PhD. So mm-hmm. I moved from a regional town. I grew up in the south coast of New South Wales, and I moved to Sydney to go to university, which was a bit of a mind-blowing experience for a girl from a fairly small town. And that was, you know, challenging working part-time and you know, trying to get really good marks in science. And in our final year, I chose animal production science. So that's looking at, you know, wool production, meat production, egg production, milk production. And I lived on campus at that time. And in my honours project was part of the course that we did in coursework and little projects. My honours project was looking at heat stress in pigs. So probably the number one thing I learnt from my undergrad degree was that pigs don't sweat mm-hmm. and they can get heat stress. If they can't wet their skin, that's why they wallow. So if they can't wet their skin, they'll pant and eventually they'll go off their food. So I was involved in a project looking at that. And I think that sort of nutritional physiology thing really excited me. And that group wanted to do a project using the same kind of techniques to measure energy metabolism in pigs. They wanted to do that in pigs with pneumonia. So they had funding there, and I applied for a scholarship from the what was then the Pig Research and Development Corporation. So that was the group that was taking money from farmers as well as money from industry to invest in research. And I was able to get a scholarship from them. So I actually stayed at the university campus at Camden to do my PhD.
So that took you to the Sydney Royal Easter Show and the Melbourne shows as well?
Yes. So I was there was a society called the Australasian, in fact it still exists, the Australasian Pig Science Association was our professional and scholarly group, and it was through contacts that I'd made there that I was invited to be part of the industry display at the Royal Sydney Show. And so they were looking for somebody who might actually do casual work, so I actually took a little leave of absence and got paid, and we lived in the exhibit and you know, we mucked the pigs out in the morning and fed them and put them to bed at night and were really part of the life of the show. And then during the day, it was all interactive and we were on microphones and talking to the public about sort of interesting pig factoids. We didn't talk about meat so much, which we might come back to that, but we would sort of talk about, you know, how pigs were quite clean. Again, the pigs don't sweat idea. We can answer questions off microphone about pig production. And it was, I think, that experience of talking to people. The ringmaster, or sorry, the not ringmaster, the guy that did the most of the announcements came and coached us. And I had this really interesting experience where I'd just done my little 8-minute spiel, because apparently people only stay in the pavilion for 8 minutes. So you could say the same thing every 10 minutes to a new audience all day. And that's pretty much what we did. So anyway, I just did my spiel, and this guy drew me over and said, "Heather, you really, really want to do a good job with this, don't you?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, the facts are really important to you, aren't they? The information, you want everyone to learn something, don't you?" And I was thinking, well, yeah, that's why I'm here. And he said, "What would it take for you, if you were hearing someone else, to think that they shouldn't be doing what they were doing?" And I said, "Oh, you know, if they were really bad, I wouldn't think it." And he said, "Exactly, if they were really bad. So relax, enjoy it. You know, you don't have to get so much information in. You can just enjoy the process, let it come out in your voice, let it come out in your face, and you'll feel a lot better about it." And I, you know, he said, "You're doing a good job, just be confident." And that was an amazing experience, actually. And I think that's when I got bitten by the science communication bug. I'd always watched, you know, the Curiosity Show as a kid and been interested in it. But that was, and even because I went to the National Youth Science Forum at the end of Year 12, you know, being exposed to Questacon and thinking, "Oh, maybe I should go back and do science communication." But I went off and straight on to do the PhD. So I think that was my first real taste of it. And I definitely got bitten by the bug, yeah.
So you've sort of moved on a little bit. You're not directly involved with science per se anymore, are you?
No. Science is, in a way, the object of my study as opposed to the way I study. Mm-hmm. So I consider myself a researcher looking in the, you know, a discipline that's known as public understanding of science, but it can also be known as science communication, really, in essence. It's also science and technology studies, and studies of science and society are slightly different again. These are like shades of grey, but it's really what I'm trying to understand is how people relate to scientific knowledge in their everyday decisions, and my area is about food. So how science in agriculture and science in food production becomes part of how people relate to food, or not how they relate to food. So that's what I'm interested in.
There are a couple of big topic subjects, aren't they? I mean, when you say science and food production, that contains some big ones like genetically modified organisms and how people react to that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, GM is probably the one that most people think of, and that's certainly the one that I've spent most of my time with. So between being a research scientist in the pig industry and doing what I'm doing now, I was the education officer for a cooperative research centre that was involved in developing genetically modified crops. And so as education officer, it was my job to, in inverted commas, enable informed decision making about the role of gene technology in food and drink. And it's one of those ones where in retrospect you think, well, how on earth are we ever going to measure that? Why would we even set that as the benchmark? And I think it was through that experience of talking to, you know, thousands of people about the science behind GM and reminding people how well regulated it was, and, you know, how GM could be part of a solution around things like food security and adapting to climate change, that I realized that a lot of the questions that people had weren't actually scientific questions. Mm-hmm. The questions around, but who's going to own the technology? How does this impact on existing, you know, farming systems? And what about the connection with use of agricultural chemicals? And particularly that ownership one, as I first mentioned, is a real sticking point for a lot of people. And they were questions that, as a science communicator working for an organisation, were kind of off topic for us. And I would go back and tell my bosses and go, you know, we really should be talking about some of these other things. And they're like, no. We're here to educate people about the science behind GM. When they're educated, then they'll like it. And I was kept going, no, I really don't think this is the case. And, of course, the scientific literature or the research literature coming out at that time was suggesting that this deficit model, this idea that there's a gap in people's heads and it's my job to fill it, that this idea was already losing favour within the scientific communication research community. And I was reading all of these papers and saying, I think we might have to think differently about what we do. But I wasn't able to generate any of that evidence myself. So that's why I toddled off to university again to learn how to do research in the humanities and social sciences.
So for a lot of people, there seems to be a bit of a disconnect between hard, you know, what they call, inverted commas, hard science and the humanities. But are you finding that there's more of a connection than people might think?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, they're both ways of, you know, and I guess even from sciences to the social sciences to the humanities, because there are fundamental differences between the social sciences and humanities as well.
Mm-hmm.
But they're all ways of finding out what it means to be human, really, and what is our place in the natural world. That's, you know, that's ultimately what we use these different tools for, to understand who we are and what we're doing here. And I think there is definitely more commonality than people realise, and particularly also too in the working lives of people, in the, you know, people who do research in academia and have a lot of shared experiences, whether they're in the sciences or not. But both or three disciplines in effect have very strict routines and rules and cultural norms. And I think once you actually learn what they are, then it's easy to move between them. But it is, there are some differences there, but there are, I think, more commonalities when you think, okay, this is all, these are all tools that we use to investigate our universe. And in some ways, one isn't necessarily better than the others.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the biggest challenge that I find at the moment is working with people who still see science as the only way and they're trained in science. They tend to sort of think, oh, but what you're doing isn't science, is it? And I'm like, yes, correct. That doesn't mean it's bad, though. It's another way of learning.
And what I'm doing can help you make you do your science better.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, the questions that we're asking about how do we produce safe, affordable, nutritious food now and into the future without ruining the planet, yeah, there's a science to that, but there's also a bigger political, economic, cultural, social question around how we actually engage people in that conversation, and that's the bit that I'm fascinated with now.
So you straddle all of these areas, science, humanities, social sciences. What are some of the biggest challenges you found?
I think one of them is being able to demonstrate that the humanities and social sciences have rigor and norms and are a unique way of thinking about the world in the same way as science is. And so, yeah, particularly when I'm dealing with people from industry, and I'm talking about agricultural industry, that may be from the meat industry or the grains production industry, when I talk to them about the kinds of research that we do, which is qualitative, so it's based on interviews, it's based on focus groups, we're not necessarily dealing with large numbers. It's not statistical like it may be in the social sciences. To actually still demonstrate that this has value and rigor and that we can actually learn a great deal from it, initially there's some resistance. So I think that is definitely a big challenge. But I think more broadly, structurally, we don't encourage collaboration a lot. I still have to put codes on my work. And when we put up grant applications, for example, we have to say what codes they are. If we're on a multidisciplinary team, you know, with people from the sciences and the humanities and the social sciences, well, where do we put it? And we don't tend to think, we tend to silo research and researchers. And it does become difficult when you genuinely want to collaborate across disciplines. You know, somebody will say, oh, well, what journal do we put it in? And the journal will only have things. And, you know, what FOR code, what field of research code do we use for this? And, you know, some disciplines don't actually reward collaboration in the same way. So in the humanities, most researchers are sole operators. They produce books and they often sole author. I come from a research culture where people work together in teams and they collaborate. And those sorts of things can be difficult. And I guess particularly now where a lot of our metrics about research are based on scientific research, I'm seeing a lot of my colleagues in the arts, in the humanities and social sciences really start to struggle with how they might be able to measure the impact of their research and how they might be able to actually be seen as doing valid and important work when we are in an environment where impact and money and widgets are really the thing that we're all supposed to be doing.
The app economy.
Yeah, that thing.
There's probably an app for that. Now,
yeah, there could be, yeah.
See, that's what you should be doing. You should be out there writing some code, put an app together, you'll be fine.
There would definitely be, that would be a way to make a lot of people happy. If we were to say, oh, we're going to make an app that's going to tell everybody what they should eat. And there already are several. But, of course, that's assuming that there is actually a scientific consensus on how we should produce our food and that somehow everyone's going to feel the same about it. That people from different cultures and different things are going to feel just as happy to eat things as other people. So, I'm not really sure I can make an app because part of my work is to actually explore how these ideas are socially constructed. So
yeah, the first app.
I would definitely get a media release out of that one.
Yeah, the first app to suggest a Hindu eat beef is probably not going to survive very long.
Yeah. Or again, even just reducing meat consumption in a country like Australia, that's something that's held very dear. And we can see that. And a lot of this stuff is really caught up in ideas that at face value, they look quite strange. Like you'd think that it would be very easy to get Australians to eat less meat, for example, if that was, one way that we could minimise impact. And I'm still not 100% sure of all the evidence there, but, it's quite clear that Australians are really attached to this idea of eating meat. So that's going to take some time, I think.
Well, I think you're going to be able. You're going to have to take our democracy sausage from our cold, dead hands. Now, you've not just worked. You haven't just worked in Australia. You've worked overseas. What's been the biggest difference for you?
I was very lucky to spend 1 year overseas in the Netherlands, and so this was 1995, 96, and I think that going to a European country at that time, was a really eye-opening experience because. I already felt like the Netherlands was just so far ahead. You could take your recycling to the supermarket, put it in a hole in the wall, get a little voucher, and that would be money taken off your next bit of shopping. That's an awesome idea. you could just go and do that. And things like family leave. Women with young children could work part-time and so could their partners. That was this idea of family leave, and they would justify it by saying, well, it just means that more people can be employed and we've got better upbringing for our children. And again, it all seemed to work really well. Unfortunately, it also coincided with a time in my life where things weren't going really well in Australia, and the fallout from that probably contributed to the end of my career, my research career originally, the first one. Definitely it was a fantastic opportunity to see that there were other ways of doing what we were doing. And I think when I came back to Australia to then find myself in a research institute that was very male-dominated, where there were very few, if any, women researchers that I can recall, and the culture of it was quite masculine, very competitive, and I started to think, well, that was the time in my life where I was thinking, well, I'd like family to be part of what I do, and thinking, this is a competition that I'm not sure I want to compete in, let alone have a chance of winning here. This is starting to get, it's starting to feel a bit more cutthroat than I thought. It's not as collegiate as I was. It's competing for funds. It's tough. It's a small pool of money, the research funding. And ironically, I'm in exactly the same position now. I'm 100% funded from grants. But I feel that obviously I'm a lot older and I'm more resilient and I'm able to cope with it a lot better. Still, ask me in September how well I'm coping. But I think at the moment I feel a lot more resilient and a lot more optimistic personally.
So, this is something I've spoken to other researchers, both men and women about. Family friendliness is not something that's particularly a thing in, say, Australia's research area, is it?
I would agree with that, yeah. I do think probably being working in a university while I've been a parent has been helpful, and certainly, you know, to take off the odd meeting, the odd bit time here and there for a meeting, and being able to work at home and make up for it. You know, I think that is a positive. However, it's, you know, the working at home to make up for it, the fact that, you know, quite often we are working more than what we're paid for, the pressure. I certainly haven't travelled very much. I was lucky enough to go to one overseas conference, and just the logistics of trying to organise that, I'm sort of wondering whether I'll ever do that again.
Mm-hmm.
Breakfast meetings, it's tricky. It isn't easy at all. I've been a single parent for the last 5 or 6 years as I've been trying to get back into research, and it's hard. It's not an easy thing at all.
Okay, is there anything else you'd like to have a chat about? Do you think we've covered it, or is there anything else?
I think, you know, when we're talking about academia and talking about science as being tricky, I do think it's important to look at, agriculture outside of academia as well.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I've been really encouraged by is how much progress is actually being made in production agriculture while I've been observing it and while I've been working alongside it. And I think there's been some fantastic little initiatives to involve women in production agriculture more. There's programs looking at women in agribusiness. There's a National Rural Woman program to enable rural women to have leadership training. There's been some fantastic little things around recognising women in farming partnerships. Many women marry onto a farm and they don't have an agricultural background and end up sort of doing the office work, you know, to help out. And programs that actually help those women find out and learn more about agriculture. One of the field days that I went to last year, a field day is where farmers go to learn about the latest new types of grain that are coming up and the latest tractors.
Now, I've been to a couple of field days myself.
Yeah, I just loved that there was a tent set up there with a little creche. There was a farmer's, there was a walk especially for the partners in grain. There was little tents for the kids to be in, and when the women could go around and they could ask questions about how things worked. And I just thought it was a brilliant little thing to see that there was something that enabled women who may not have a big role in agriculture and who may also be looking after kids to still be part of that day. And I think those are the kinds of changes we may still need in academia as well, as making sure that parents with young children can still participate equally.
And a big thank you to Dr. Heather Bray for taking the time to have a chat. Dr. Bray's experiences in academia and science are not, unfortunately, all that uncommon, and these are questions that we do need to answer about how we can make science more accessible and, I don't know what the best way to describe it is, more open to less traditional approaches to career advancement. As always, the theme music for this episode was Coco-Cur by Texas Radio Fish and is licensed Creative Commons Attribution. Of course, you can find it at dig.ccmixter.org. And of course, if you know of a woman in the STEM fields who you think would be a good fit for this podcast or you'd like to hear more from, please let me know at james@angrybeanie.com. Talk to you later.